things. There's the ride-alongs, etc. And slowly, the very serious aspects of this seep in. Not so much classes out, fun's over, but sort of, wow, this is a real job with real big responsibilities and a real information management job. There's so much stuff he has to know. It's like a lawyer, medic, pilot, arbitrator, negotiator, gun expert, crime scene. I mean, you're kind of literally the jack of all trades for what you're doing. Is that a fair description of how it is to get into law enforcement?
It is. There's a huge learning curve when you first want to get into law enforcement. A lot of us, some of us get a preconceived notion off of television, which TV is fairly accurate, but there's a lot of drama. But you are absolutely correct. You have to know a lot of things. And one of the other things that we really don't talk about is you're almost like a junior social worker. You have to know where to refer people at any given time. Everything from directions for tourists who may be lost to maybe there's a key venue in your city and people are always looking for that. You have to know those things. And you are correct with the firearms law, and everything's constantly changing. As case law changes, you have to stay up on that. An example would be that when I went to the academy, a seatbelt violation was a secondary stop, meaning you couldn't pull someone over for not wearing your seatbelt. Well, over time, that's changed, and now that is a primary reason to pull someone over. But little things like that change along the way, you have to stay up on it, and you've got to stay with the times because it changes it tremendously.
So you talked about the learning curve. There's also a how you handle things curve. Is that right?
Yes, there is.
And talk about that. How you can, as an officer with 11 and a half years, much like in medicine, you can tell who's been around and who's relatively new. Not casting aspersion on, you know, a new officer, a new doctor, but there's a real difference in how things are done and how much at ease and how much stress it puts on people. Familiarity sometimes takes that away a little bit, but talk about the curve and what are the things that make that curve either steep or smooth, and when does that happen?
I think that would be almost like an individual case-by-case basis. By and large, most people who are law enforcement, they have a sense of community involvement, they have a sense of duty, and I know what goes along with that is obviously the intent to want to help people. But everyone that comes in, everything that they've experienced in their life up to that point predisposes them to being resilient in the realm of law enforcement, meaning we could almost say that life is defined on how we as individuals deal with stress. What may be stressful for me may not be stressful for you or the next person beside us. And I had 12 years of military prior to my career in law enforcement, and I was pretty resilient, but I didn't have an appreciation for all the stress that came along with being in law enforcement. And over time, it does wear you down if you don't have a healthy outlet. And as far as rookies, I think we call rookies the new guys, they come into law enforcement, they're excited. They want to go almost like sometimes chase their shadow because they're always excited and want to do the right thing. They want to help people. And over time, the violence you're exposed to, the stress, the hypervigilance, wing shifts, administrative stress, it begins to chip away at your armor. You know, just like you put on your vest, you need to put on mental armor to go to work every day. And if you're not mindful of that and you forget to put your armor on, some days can be more stressful than others, and that can really get people down in the dumps. They can. We in law enforcement are predisposed to dysthymia, which is a low-level onset of depression. We're also prone to post-traumatic stress disorder and heart disease just from basic stress of the job. A lot of, and you'll see these people, the officers, veteran officers have a more laid-back approach to law enforcement. They've already got all the excitement out, and they're in the maintenance phase of their career, and they take a little bit more time with people, where rookies may be more prone to make a quick arrest. A lot of the older officers or veteran officers will tend to take their time and ask more detailed questions, not only to get the why, but some of the backstory to that, and shows a little bit more of a humanistic approach to it. It just comes in time.
So on that vein about the how you process things, in your experience, when you see a new officer, or even, as you say, in the maintenance phase or in the stable phase, however it may be defined, of the career, what and how do you place markers or reevaluate at certain points to say you're here or you're too much here or relax here or step it up here? How do you get your mind around that for the very differentiation between officers that you just talked about? Who's doing okay, not okay, too fast, too slow? How do you work that?
It would usually varies by agency. One of the positives of being around a large agency, such as Orlando Police Department, Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, NYPD, they have their own separate, most of them have their own separate department psychologists. And that someone is paid on staff that the officers can go to at any given time. Others, such as Titusville, we have approximately 88 sworn. We don't have the financial structure to support a full-time psychologist or psychiatrist. So we have to turn to other things. We launched a peer support team at our department. The peer support team's job is to be a resource for officers that may be having a bad day, just left a bad call or a call that may have been a little unusual that reminded them of something from their past. And we also have some really good supervisors that keep an eye on their officers, and they can notice, for example, if I was to come into work every day and I'm happy-go-lucky and I'm happy to be there and I'm smiling, and one day I come in and, you know, I'm just kind of disconnected a little bit. I'm not engaging as I usually am. You know, they can pull me aside and say, hey, you know, Jeff, something's going on. Can you tell me about that? And they're really good at getting on top of that and saying, look, it seems like you're under a lot of stress or you're having a bad day. How about we can send you home, or we can let you sit here at the station and maybe answer some telephone calls. Or in some cases, we have the employee assistance program. If the problem exceeds the scope of the peer support team, we can then send that person to EAP at no charge to get them the services they need, like a divorce. A law enforcement, we're unfortunately known for chronic divorces, and so if we're going through a divorce or financial counseling or even some PTSD, we have some officers that were in the military that have the potential for PTSD. We can refer those people to EAP to get them services. But on a day-to-day basis, it really comes down to their peers, to their zone partners. Our city has zones, we call them sectors or districts, but it's a person you're toe-to-toe with or got your back on calls for service. They're the first people that's going to notice an issue. And luckily for us, we have the officers that are able to recognize that and to say, hey, look, Jeff, looks like you're having a bad day. Let's talk about that. And it helps us blow off some steam.
Now, on that topic, and we talked about this briefly before the show, on the aspect of the response, and you and I talked about, you know, I have some friends in law enforcement, and I'm not in law enforcement. I don't think I got the stones to handle that extreme stress. I mean, the ER is one thing, but they're generally not trying to get to me. What are the common, but I think to the public, very severely underrated stressful circumstances that are utterly routine? People see one and go, but of course, we talk, the first thing that comes to mind is, for me, is the traffic stop, which I know from some of the officers I've talked to is like the super easiest or ultimate scary and anything in between circumstance. How does that so-called simple thing, how does that get approached, and over time, how does that change an officer's sort of mental readiness, mental state, and of course the stressful end of it? That seemed to be spooky to me.
It can be very scary. In the academy, we start off teaching the officers to be between every traffic stop as if it's going to be their last. And it's the reason we do that is if we become complacent and we're not on our red alert or we're not on our guard, there's a high potential that we could be killed on a traffic stop. And a lot of complaints come in from the citizens thinking the officer's too aggressive, when really it manifests that way, but the officer is just trying to be very careful. When I was a field training officer, I would tell all my guys and gals I was training to treat every car as if there's a bad guy in it until you can check the car out and ensure that maybe it's his grandma or maybe it's your aunt or some other law-abiding citizen that may have made a simple error in judgment driving, such as speeding or didn't use their turn signal or something else. But that in itself, a traffic stop, is a huge stressor for law enforcement. It's a complete unknown walking up to the car. There could be a minister on his way to church or someone who's escaped from a prison in another state running from law enforcement. You just do not know who's in that car until you walk up and you look inside. And a lot of it's the fear of the unknown. And there's a huge adrenaline dump. And it's not just the aspect of writing a citation. It's just the fear of the unknown that always weighs on your mind. And I warn people, if they lose that feeling of walking up to the car, they might want to reevaluate what's going on in your life and not make that complacency or to let that get into their life or in the way of their officer safety on a traffic stop.
So this is, as I've read, the equivalent of clearing a building in Iraq. In the public perception, I don't think that there's an equation like that in the average person's mind. I know it is in mine. Is there a need to give the public a better perspective of just how scary it is to do what we see as the ho-hum routine stuff?
You have to treat everything as if it's your last. And you always have to be hypervigilant, almost to a fault. And that's where the heart disease aspect and everything comes in, because you're always on red alert, waiting for the next danger around the corner. By and large, the biggest tip I could ever give anyone in the public, if you're ever pulled over, obviously you want to make sure it's a legitimate law enforcement officer behind you. 99% of them there are. And pull over in a safe area. If it's nighttime, pull over in a well-lit area. Roll down all your windows. If you're a four-door, roll down the back windows. And just rest your hands on the steering wheel and just greet the officer. Good evening, officer. Good afternoon. Good night. And then the officer immediately, when he sees that or she sees that, they can immediately go, oh, okay, this person's doing the right thing. So that helps them with their officer safety because they can see your hands. You don't want to rummage around in your purse or in your pockets or in the glove box, center console. So that's furtive movements, and we don't know if you're going to get a weapon, get your driver's license, or what you're going for. It's just, again, the fear of the unknown that can be very scary.
I have a question. I live in a neighborhood that has many families who are now a bit more mature, and some of them I have to bring back home when I find them wandering. And some of them don't have the memory that they used to or the agility. And when they see someone in uniform, they become frightened. I wanted to know. I was talking to a neighbor, and she said, I don't dare call the police officers when my sister is sick because she's terrified of them, and it'll make a whole big roo-ha-ha. What is the right approach? What is the behavior that the family should have when they call, say, I need help, help me with a relative or a neighbor? What is the, how should the people who call behave so that they're not in the way and they're more solution than obstruction?
I would recommend anyone that's having an issue as a loved one that likes to wonder, please, by all means, give us a of being in law enforcement. There's a huge divide between the public and what they perceive and law enforcement. Unfortunately, it keeps getting wider that when I grew up in North Carolina, the officers were someone to respect them. They're there to help you. They're there in a time of need. And over time, there's been some bad apples that's tarnished the job and the badge that make it difficult for the rest of us to play catch-up to earn a public trust. And several years ago, I was teaching a class of volunteers, and I'd made a reference to a law enforcement-sensitive database that we have. And one of the people was concerned that we would keep a secret file on people, and I can assure you, no one keeps secret files on people at Titusville Police Department. We just don't have time, really, but also we don't really, that's not the way we do law enforcement. It's completely separate. The only files we have is our records division that maintains our reports that we're required by law to have. And we just pull reference material from records. So if you're a normal citizen and you've done nothing wrong, please, by all means, give us a call. Don't wait until it's too late. And having said that, we have a program in Florida called Triad. And Triad is a partnership that allows people, like, say, for Alzheimer's patients or people that wonder, we can provide the families with a GPS device for their loved one. Much like we have people on probation with GPS monitors, same idea, only smaller. And if the person wonders, we have a receiver on our local sheriff's office helicopter, and they can fly over and pinpoint us where the loved ones are at and recover relatively quickly.
That's exactly what I had in mind, because I noticed that they're unable to talk, and I asked, do you know where you live? And they don't know. And when they see, I've already, of course, called for help, and then when the squad car pulls up, they start shaking. And they think, yes. No, they're going to arrest me. They're going to arrest me. And I explain, no, they're not. They're just going to tell us what to do and how to get help. No. And what happens is, to avoid that fear, the relatives and the neighbors both don't call when they need to, because they're afraid that they're going to make the situation worse. And
oh, no.
I live in a neighborhood where we have many elderly neighbors, and they do get lost sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to find, what is the right way that we ask for help?
Oh, certainly. Anytime that you have someone like that, the first thing to do, obviously, is if it's a dire emergency, please, by all means, call 911 immediately. And when try to remain calm. I know it's easy for me to say because someone is there talking to you guys and people listening, but try to remain calm. The dispatcher on the other end, most of the time, has 99% of the time, has no idea who you are or why you're calling, but they're there to help. And if you're agitated or you're yelling into the phone, it makes it very difficult for them to hear. Try to remain calm and give as many details as you can, such as height, weight, clothing, do they have facial hair or not, long hair, short hair, any possible direction of travel that allows us to get a bigger picture of what's going on. And it's unfortunate that you say that people have the fear of law enforcement. It's unfortunate that they do that. I'm really sorry that they feel that way, but for me personally, I would hate to think that people would fear me just because of my uniform, especially average citizens.
Some of them are Alzheimer's patients, and they don't understand what's happening to them.
For us, we use it. It's been my experience that with Alzheimer's patients, a lot of times they regress back to their teenage years or their early 20s, their formative years when they had girlfriends, boyfriends, and were sneaking out of the house. And a lot of times they're trying to find those comfort areas. They're seeking out those, it's almost like Linus in his blanket, as they're looking around and trying to get back to their comfort zone from when they were that age, wherever that was, whether it was Titusville or Jacksonville or another state. They're looking for that area that they're familiar with. And one of the tools that I've been looking into for our department, there's a company that sells a handheld device that has a fingerprint reader. And in it is a built-in Alzheimer's database. And it's completely voluntary. So if you have a loved one with Alzheimer's, you can come down to the police department Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. We can fingerprint them, take their picture, take their history, where they live, emergency contacts. And that instrument goes into the handheld unit. And if we do, we're looking for your cousin or your aunt or whoever it is, your parents, we can enter their name in the Alzheimer's database, and it pulls up their picture and all their information. So then we know who we're looking for. We can email that to all the officers' cars so they can, you know, have a picture. And all, as adult learners, which all of us are, we learn by seeing, most of us do. So if we have a picture, we can see that and know who we're looking for. And then we can say, oh, well, this is Aunt so-and-so, and she has Alzheimer's. And then we can take a different approach to how we approach the person to ascertain how they're doing. Do they need medical attention? Do they know where they are? I've recovered many Alzheimer's patients that left Jacksonville or Orlando and ended up in Titusville thinking they're in, like, Kentucky or Georgia.
And I'm sorry that all my questions are surrounding my neighborhood and the people that I love around me. And by the way, I live in the La Cita area of Titusville, Florida. I wanted to say that we also have the incidences of well, young people who come to prey on the elderly and people that are a bit more mature. And what about products? When they start bringing them, for instance, bicycles is a perfect example, and things that they've come across in the street, my fear is that those products or those things might be stolen. And I explained to my neighbors, if you accept those products, they're not going to say when they look at the serial number, oh, geez, you had nothing to do with it. They're going to assume you're dealing with a stolen item. I'm trying to encourage my neighbors not to accept things that street people or a transient or someone from who doesn't have a home just brings them a product and says, here, give me some money for it. I always fear that it might be a stolen product. Could you tell us about that?
You can't go door to door without a permit. And if someone does come to your house offering you some good, of course, cash or money, I would ask to see their permit. And if they don't have it, I would turn them away, say, no, thank you, but without a permit, I can't help you, and be nice about it. And then when you close your door, please call us and let us know that this person's in your neighborhood. And you are correct. It seems that society, a certain element, likes to prey on the elderly. And they know that the elderly are more trusting, that they're more giving, and they use that to their advantage to essentially bilk the elderly out of money.
Oh, my. And I also worry because the elderly who have a high degree of medication, an established senior citizen, hanging out with a 20-year-old, I know something's terribly wrong because there's no reason for them to be together except that one must want something. And I find that the drugs, the painkillers, for instance, become very attractive to these people. And I want to know, is there an organization that I could refer my neighbors to when they are being harassed by people who are annoying them for cash or bringing them stolen goods and things of that nature? What should that elderly person do? What should we recommend to them?
I recommend that they call their local law enforcement agency. We have a vast amount of resources, such as undercover officers, vice units, and even Mark Patrol, that can help them and provide them with information and referrals or general information. As you, for those that don't know, Florida has finally changed their laws looking at prescriptions and the pill mills, they call them, and prescription drugs, and especially abuse of prescription drugs, is huge in Florida, or was huge in Florida. And a lot of times...
Kevin, what's your experience in Anchorage with that?
Actually, I think that's a whole separate topic.
Please continue. I've asked the questions that I wanted to ask about the neighbors and such, because they specifically asked me to ask about those things. So everyone is happy now that they've heard their answers. So, gentlemen, continue. We just have an arrival of Dr. Sockerman, who's going to be joining Syndicated News and helping everybody in the future, Dr. McGuire and Police Officer Watson, when he comes back in the future. Dr. Sockerman, are you there?
The society we live in now is one where that harm is permissible. It could be that in the future, it won't be regarded as safe anymore, because people will be a little more aware of how psychological and emotional harm actually is not entertainment. Their sense of well-being and emotional safety after that show and during that show, we would see that harm is actually occurring.
What about communities? Do you see any difference in the method that communities are helping one another, say in Europe versus the U.S.? Because I remember when I was in Europe that there was a woman, I think in her 50s, 55, 60, and she was alone. Her parents had passed away, but she was disabled. And the entire block, all the houses on the block, took turns managing her care, just making sure that they kept an eye on her. And I was thinking, what a wonderful thing. Why don't we do that in the United States?
Most collectivistic in societies actually would do exactly as you describe, where the idea of it takes a village to raise a child, or the idea of everybody is their brother's keeper, that's kind of the mentality of that society. And then there's other societies which are very individualistic, where everybody is out to look after number one, or to look after number one and his or her own family. So it might explain some of what you've observed in parts of Europe versus parts of the United States, where there are parts of Europe where the culture is still very Greek. You know, the culture is still very collectivistic and very community focused, and it's almost like everybody else's business is your business as well. And of course, there's pros and cons to both types of society.
Yes, I agree, and I see that clearly. What about the children in the school systems? Because I notice they're getting pretty hot and bothered, and they're getting pretty violent as well. I'm talking about the 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds. Do you have a suggestion for the school districts to deal with? Obviously, these children are upset and stressed out, and when they get to school, they're already excited and looking for a fight. What recommendations, any?
Oh, so many recommendations.
Give us a few.
A kid who is a bully, a kid who is getting in fights,
yes,
is a child who does not have a safe and nurturing home environment.
That's where the bullying is coming from, isn't it?
Oh, it's most often the case. When the teachers and the school would become concerned and would be able to provide family therapy for that child and his or her family. Because if the problem is only addressed at school, then you're simply dealing with a child's behavior. And a child's behavior can be improved upon at school only so much without it seeming like punishment, without it seeming punitive, without it seeming scary. And if they learn something at school and go home and have none of what they learned nurtured by a loving and stable home environment, whatever they learned at school won't make a difference.
And let's give a minute to our listeners who came to listen to Officer Jeff Watson and Dr. Kevin McGuire. We love them both, but we are experiencing lightning, and lightning will disconnect Skype and phones and things of that nature. And we've had very severe weather, as you know. And I thought perhaps I had done something different or wrong, but I'm getting the message now that the lightning is affecting us. So please forgive us. We are going to have Officer Jeff Watson back, absolutely, and Dr. McGuire, of course. But we can't fight with nature. That's just the weather. There's nothing we can do about that. Dr. Sockerman, go on. I had another question about, we were talking about the elderly and calling in. It's wonderful, the information that Officer Jeff Watson has to offer. And I'm sure we'll do this again. We'll get him back on again very soon because he's near me. He's not far away. He's in my town. And my next question is about teenagers at night when they're on the street with the noise and the whole bit. How dangerous can it be? What approach should an adult take in dealing with young people who are sometimes inebriated or high? What recommendations? Because I've seen that in an area where they were celebrating 4th of July, for instance. And the young people, 18, 19, I couldn't tell. Some of them looked much younger. But the point is, they were out of control. And I stayed away because I knew that I didn't have the wherewithal. I didn't have the skill to control the situation and manage them. What do you recommend?
I think that your intuition was actually very accurate. If these kids are behaving this way and you don't interfere, they won't interfere most likely. Of course, it depends the neighborhood and the situation. If we're talking about a criminal group of children, so if we're talking about a gang, or if we're talking about people who are out to commit crime, then that's a very different situation. That's probably a time of day where you should not be out. You should not be out in that neighborhood at that time of day, because if there's a likelihood of that being the situation you're going to encounter, then the safest bet is simply not to be there. But if it's a case of kids just being inebriated or being under the influence of drugs and just quote-unquote having a good time together, your best course of action, I think, is exactly the one you took. You know, you're going where you're going. They are where they are. And, you know, if you don't interact with them, they'll have no big reason to interact with you.
And I have another question, because I have someone asking me, they're sending me a message and asking me, Judge Michelle Lawrence and Jill Ejizi have a show called Family Matters every other Wednesday, and they deal with parental alienation. And one of the questions is that one of the parents has been assigned supervised visitation by the judge. And at that point where they're transferring the child, it gets very contentious. What recommendation do you have in managing that for the parent who's bringing that child to a circumstance? I mean, I'm sure I could see if it was me, I would try to avoid it. They have to bring the child against their will to the other parent whom they're fighting with and they're at odds with. What recommendation would you make for safety?
Who is supervising the visits?
A social worker.
So is the social worker already there when the parents bring it?
Yes.
So honestly, it's one of those situations where if that is the pattern.
Yes, that is the pattern for almost all the visits. The minute the parent that's angry being supervised, they're so angry because actually this parent and this parent is actually a decent parent, but in the argument back and forth, in the anger, they started making accusations, and they don't realize that now the Child Protective Service people take those accusations as they're written in stone, as though they're true, even though they're said in anger.
Mm-hmm.
And now they start acting as though those accusations are true. And I find this again and again, for instance, when one parent is angry at the other. Oh, no, you know, he touched the child. I can't tell you how often I hear that. It's so, like the automatic response. It's the automatic thing to say when you don't want the other parent to have the child. And I see it again and again.
If there's a pattern of that transaction always being this way, and if these two parents have a lot of unsolved business with one another, as you're describing, then I would suggest two things. One, that the parents and Child Protective Services actually have a talk or a series of talks with the child not being there. So this could happen either via mediation, or it could happen via Child Protective Services procedure. And the other suggestion that I would have is the parent bringing in the child, parks the car, hands the child over to the social worker, and the social worker walks into the house where the other parent is. But the parents themselves do not see each other and do not interact.
But I agree.
And that would just avoid the potential or the possibility, because at this point, with this much level of anger, even seeing the other parent sounds like it's a trigger.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely right. And when I did supervised visitation, I would actually take the child on one corner, ask the parent to bring me the child at one corner, and I would walk up the sidewalk to the other corner, and that seemed to give the one parent just gave me the child, give them an opportunity to drive away, and
mm-hmm.
then I would call the other parent about 20 minutes later.
There you go.
To avoid, and that worked a lot. That
there
worked,
you go.
That was pretty effective. But
mm-hmm.
I see that coming up all the time. And one of the, there are so many issues. We are so glad to have you. It's Syndicated News.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Because, you know, with the children and the parents and all of these issues with parental alienation and divorce, all the behaviors that seem to be automatic in a parent that's angry.
Mm-hmm.
We love to discuss all those things. And sometimes I don't have the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Officer Watson, his whole focus is mental health counseling. So he's very well versed in this type of thing. So I can't wait to have him back again and have him give us some information about that. And now tell us, psychotherapy, exactly what is that? That's the question I'm getting online.
So you have callers asking, what exactly is psychotherapy?
Exactly what it, that's the question exactly.
Okay. So
what's the definition, she wants to know?
The definition would be simple. There is some part of your life which you find unsatisfactory, unfulfilling, or dysfunctional. There's some part of your life that is really not working for you,
mm-hmm.
and most often is not working for those closest to you as well. And this is something that you have tried to improve upon.
Mm-hmm.
This is something you have really given it thought, and you've given it effort, and you've tried to improve upon it. But I don't know, maybe after a few months or a few years, you come to the realization that it's not improving. It's not improving as much as you would like, and it's not improving as much as those you care about would like. Psychotherapy is the tool to help you improve upon those things. And you, ideally, are the one in charge all the time of what those things are. A genuine therapist who cares about your interests will always put you in the front seat, will always say, like to work on and improve, and let's do only that. So a lot of people have fear of therapy because of a lot of media and a lot of stigma and a lot of stereotypes of what therapy was 100 years ago and actually no longer is.
And I also wanted to ask you about issues concerning divorce. As I said, sometimes in divorces, people begin to, split up. And now the antagonism begins where they were getting along and divorcing normally. Now the police have to be called in, and that becomes quite a problem. What do you recommend to solve things so that they can be calm and relaxed and we can find a way to get them through it? Is there a way to get them through it?
So, you know, when it comes to questions like these, it's hard to answer. And in general terms, because every couple and every individual is so specific and unique.
Mm-hmm.
However, in generality, it's safe to say that mediation is an incredible tool. So many, many, many cities have these community mediation centers. Also, many courts provide mediation. And for people who are not interested in therapy, who are not interested in going deep into an issue or trying to understand the emotional and intellectual reasons behind every interaction, mediation is almost like a quick fix.
Yes, I know.
A mediator will just help people be able to figure out how to make this happen in the most civil and harmless way possible. So the alternative is to go to couples counseling. A lot of people go to couples counseling to get a divorce, to have that happen in a way that would minimize and mitigate the really, really harmful behaviors that a lot of people fall into while getting divorced.
And also I wanted to ask you, I'm taking the questions right from the group. They're coming right online. They're also asking about, of course, dementia. That comes up often because I live in an area where there is it's a mature population.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to ask about that. And they're asking about one particular case where a spouse wound up in the hospital with the wife, took the spouse to the hospital, and they didn't feel that the spouse was giving the right medication or care or something to that effect. The point is, it became a whole adult protective services situation, and now they've taken the wife from the husband, and it's become it's just a tragic situation, and it's winding up in the Supreme Court. What are things that one can do to help a family experience this problem of one of the spouses aging and then having to deal with it? How can we handle that in a tender, emotional... tender is the best word I can think of. In a tender way so that all parties involved are addressed and respected and taken care of.
It's such a deep issue.
I know. We can't fix it on the radio right now, but at the very least, if you could just give them something...
Sure. When the state comes into your home and tells you how to raise your child or how to take care of your elderly family member, and in their telling you of how to do that, they tell you that you're doing a poor job, that you are endangering that child, that you are endangering that elderly individual. This is a tragic, tragic event in any family's life because their sense of personal freedom, their sense of efficacy, their sense of being able to provide, caretake, and nurture, that sense is removed by the state. And as we know, the state usually does not have all the information, does not have the capability of observing the day in and day out of a family's home, and they will make decisions. And other times, the state makes a decision without having all the required information. And honestly, the word tender is very, very apropos, because it's a family tragedy to lose your child or to lose your elderly family member at the hands of the state.
And also, I wanted to mention to family members, if you have someone who's lost some of the cognitive skill, who's lost some of the sensibilities, you have to act as the protector to that individual. I have a relative who suffers from a few little glitches, I call them, and I have to constantly protect that relative's civil rights, even, because people immediately think, oh, that person has this condition, I can just step in here and do what I want. And I have to constantly get between people and that relative and say, no, you can't. That person has rights. No, you can't. Leave the person alone. And I have to do it often enough, because for years, the outsiders, I call them, or the transients, got so used to taking advantage of people who were less capable of defending themselves that they take it as a matter of course. And to relatives, I tell you, learn how to protect your elderly, learn how to protect your disabled, because if you don't protect them and the machine, I call it the machine, of the state steps in, not only does that relative lose rights, but you do too. That family gets ripped up.
And I think that's a great word, protect, because the state gets involved when they come to the awareness that somebody has witnessed a dangerous behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So if the elderly person you're taking care of can be coached by you, or can have you engineer your schedule, engineer the way that the house works, so that they're not ever in the position to do something unsafe, then the state will have no way to witness an unsafe behavior, right? So if the state gets worried because the elderly person gets lost once a month and is found on the highway walking and scared, then the person who's taking care of that elderly person needs to protect them by ensuring that they are not able to leave the house unattended, right? And that means that you can have family members hang out with them all the time. That means that you can make sure that you can reach them by cell phone at all times, and they'll know how to pick that up. And it's a very persistent effort that the caretaker needs to have to ensure that that person is always being regarded as safe and functional. Otherwise, the state is not going to feel comfortable with this person being unattended.
And as I recommend to all family members, learn to protect your infirm, learn to protect your elderly, so that you don't have strangers step in and make all sorts of decisions for you that you're not going to like in the long run. Make good decisions, make them swiftly, and make them all the time. And let it be known that you protect that individual. And do it actively, don't do it passively, because a person's civil liberties could disappear in 5 minutes. I remember I was trying to help my relative with a financial matter, and one of the institution's employees said, oh, that I know what to do, just have the person declared incompetent. And I said, the person's not incompetent. The person's just not feeling well right now. And I was thinking how quickly they jumped to that conclusion, because it's expedient for them. So you have to protect your relatives. You have to protect them in every way.
Yeah, it's a very serious issue, and it requires You know when a baby is born, the first year and a half?
Yes.
It's a 24/7 job to provide and nurture for that child.
Absolutely. Oh, I agree. I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
And I can't thank you enough for...
Oh, you're welcome.
...helping me with these questions, because I have no medical training at all. I have none, so I don't know how to help. And I am so glad you came, and I'm so glad that Officer Watson came this evening, and we're going to have him back. And Dr. Sockerman, we really would like you to come on back soon this week and talk to the Stewarts and talk to Judge Michelle Lawrence from Chicago, Illinois, and talk to Jill Ajizi, and in fact, talk about the military and their suffering. Members of the military are suffering in huge numbers. In fact, this year has recorded the highest number of suicides amongst the military in history.
It's incredibly...
We're going to be talking about, and we're going to be bringing all the medical gentlemen back.
Great.
And I can't thank you enough, and we're down to our last 2 minutes. I thank you so much for coming and saving this hour.
Thank you as well. Thank you as well.
I wasn't able to retain their calls. I couldn't stop them. And I was watching the little black box go red, which means it's letting go of the line. But I thank you for helping us and joining us.
It's my pleasure. And I look forward to many, many more of these questions and answers. I really enjoyed the questions that you asked and the questions that your listeners asked. Very, very valid, important questions.
Five of them are asking when you're coming back. I'll post it on the front face of syndicatednews.net. I'll post when he's going to be with us so that you'll know.
And I really enjoyed the interest that people have to all these topics. You know, a person who is interested is a person who is growing. A person who is curious is a person who is evolving. So anytime somebody asks you a question, that person is doing the opposite of being stagnant. That person is actually taking care of their development as a human being just by the fact of being curious about something and being curious about how to understand that something better.
Well, I bid you good night, and I thank you again for your courtesies. Thank you so much for joining us. I am so grateful.
Thank you.
And I know we will talk after the show about the next time you come on, and I tell you, we're going to find a way to deal with lightning even.
Okay. Well, I hope you have a good night as well.
You too. Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.